Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, the films of Pedro Almodovar. My guest this week is Alejandro Varela, who was a mostly closeted college student when he left the U.S. for a semester in Spain. There, he was able to start fresh, come out, and explore a queer culture with a little inspiration from filmmaker Pedro Almodovar, and to come back to the U.S. a completely changed person. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder to head over to mattbaume.com to subscribe to my newsletter and take a look at my YouTube channel for videos about film and TV history. And head over to my Patreon to support The Sewers of Paris and watch hours of bonus videos about super queer pop culture. Lately, I've been posting behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Will and Grace. Now, here's my conversation with Alejandro. Well, this week I'm speaking with Alejandro Varela, a writer in New York. Thanks so much for joining me.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Matt.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
It would have to be the film Todo Sobre Mi Madre. All About My Mother by Pedro Almodovar.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that. I don't know that we talk about his films very much on the show, so I'm excited to have an opportunity to do that. How did you find that film, and what was your impression of it?
I was living in Spain at the time. I was doing a semester abroad in Sevilla, and I had studied his films in a class I was taking at the University of Sevilla. But I don't think at that point I had seen anything by him. I had heard of Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, but that was about it. And maybe I'd heard about something, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, Atame with Antonio Banderas, because there was something queerish about the poster, and maybe I'd seen it at some point. But for sure, I hadn't seen their films. I'd only heard the name. And and he's maybe Spain's most important filmmaker, or in the last 30 years. So anyway, he was on my mind, and that film was still in theaters, and it was the big one that was going to be nominated for the Oscar. And so all of Spain was abuzz, and my mother came to visit. And she flew into Madrid for work, and I met her, right? So at some point in the trip, I met with her. That's a lie. That's not true. My bad. She came to Sevilla. She went to Madrid for work and then made her way to Sevilla. And I said, let's go see a film together. And she said, okay, what's out? And I said, well, I want to see this film by Pedro Almodovar. And she'd heard of him, but also hadn't seen his work, I don't think. And I said, sure. And I was nervous because I had just come out in college to a handful of people. I think maybe my brother knew at that point, but I hadn't told anyone else. But in Spain, I was out. People only knew me as queer, as gay. And so maybe they knew me as bi. We can talk about that later. But I didn't know exactly what the film was going to be about. I don't even think I'd watched a trailer for it. And it is pretty queer. And I was wondering how my mom felt about it. And I never asked her. But I remember being in the theater wondering, thinking, oh, is this uncomfortable? Does she think that I'm sort of coming out by bringing her to this film? Mm-hmm. So all those things were on my mind as I was watching the film. And the film was brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, can you describe for like folks who haven't seen it, like what is it about?
So it is a story of Manuela, who is a nurse. I can't remember what city she's in, but she's a single mom, and she takes her son Esteban for his 17th birthday to see, he's begged her to see A Streetcar Named Desire and the play. And when they leave the theater, he becomes sort of just focused on getting the autograph of the lead actress, played by Marisa Paredes, Uma Rojo. And he gets hit by a car in the process of trying to get this autograph, and he dies. And she makes the trip back to find his father, who she left 17 years earlier, in order to tell him that he had a son and that he died. And then we learn that she also seems to be on the trail of this traveling play. And so she befriends the actress and becomes her assistant, and it becomes a play on not only, we have this play here, Streetcar Named Desire, happening. We also are kind of have a reworking of All About Eve happening, because she lies about who she is, and she becomes the assistant to the lead actress and causes all these issues. And that's, you know, the move all about my mo the movie's called All About My Mother, but it's a tribute to All About Eve and to Streetcar Named Desire. In any case, so she goes back and she is reunited with a cast of people that from her previous life, and in particular, Lagrado, played by Antonia San Juan, so it's a trans actress. And I think that is one of the reasons why this movie was so important to me, or so memorable, isn't just how beautifully it's written, the complications, the tributes to other films, the acting, which is off the charts. Everyone is amazing. It's also the first time I had seen a as close to a three-dimensional, fully formed trans character and played by a trans actor. And she is amazing and should have been nominated and won Best Supporting Actress at the Oscars, in my opinion. But yeah, so that's a bit about this film.
So you mentioned that you were out in Spain, but not really out in the US. It must have felt like you're kind of like living two different lives on opposite sides of the ocean.
I remember in a way, and I remember I had three friends from college come to visit who I've been out to already in college. And when they came, they just looked at me and they said, one of them started, I think she started to cry. She said, couldn't be happier at how free and happy you seem. And I didn't realize that, you know. I was just sort of living my life there. I mean, I wasn't fully out. I was still kind of nervous. When is the assault coming? When is someone going to jump me? When is, you know, I have to be careful. But I also went out and I had friends and no one had ever known me as anything but gay. And so that was such a unique experience to happen at that point in my life. So to kind of tumble into that film, which is just a splash of it's, I mean, all of Almodóvar's films are explosions of color, in particular red, which is, I think, his favorite. But yeah, that to me was I love that that film in some ways is the backdrop to that experience for me, those 6 months that I was living there, that coming out and just kind of being.
And so after the movie ends, how did your mother take the experience?
She said, oh, that was good. That was interesting. A bit strong, don't you think? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And I've since, you know, I think I made her watch it, her and my dad watch it one more time. And now they really appreciate it. And I think they both like it and they don't love it the way I do. I watch it every couple of years.
Did that
And
change anything for you? Like being in Spain, did you find the, I don't know, the way that you thought of yourself or the way that you thought of where you were living changed?
in a way, I mean, Spain is still Europe, so it's pretty white. And it's kind of interesting to be around an entire country of mostly white Spanish speaking people. I mean, there are other languages spoken, respect to Galician and Basque and other languages, but by and large, everyone speaks what we know as Spanish. And it was kind of interesting. You know, folks were like, where are you from? And I think maybe some people thought I was probably Roma, which we know is Gypsy, but it was. I mostly hung out with my college classmates, university mates, a couple guys I dated that were locals, which that was kind of a cool experience. Yeah, I mean, I was what they as the kids say now, I was living my best life there. It was pretty amazing. Yeah.
What was the gay community in Spain like?
Relative to what I had known before, pretty out and proud. I guess I met a couple of closeted guys, you know. There were in that in Sevilla, which was not the largest city in Spain. There were several gay bars and dance clubs that I would go to regularly. So there were options, which was a big jump from my small college town in upstate New York, where there was one place that you had to have a car to drive out to. So I felt like it was easier. It was definitely easier to be gay and to be out. I felt like there was a bit more respect. There's definitely what there is here, misogyny and machismo and all that stuff. But maybe it's because I was a stranger. I didn't internalize all of it, you know. It was for me, it was a different vibe, so I could take advantage of my foreignness and be a little freer.
What kind of what were you doing in, like what were your studies? Like what were you there to like officially do?
General liberal arts, with a lot of sort of Southern Spanish history. Yeah. I mean, I took film class, I took history of Spain, took not geography, world history. It's as if I was taking a general liberal arts semester, but in southern Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the second half of my junior year. So then I went back to college and did another year.
Did you feel like you were a different person when you came back? Like you had that, all that time to be out and explore being queer in Europe and in Spain. So who's the person who came back?
Oh, hell yes. I was much more empowered. I dropped the whole bi thing. Respect to my bi brothers and sisters, but I was not bi, never was. I think it was just like a safe haven for me, you know, like a pit stop. I totally took advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back and I was just comfortable being out, told a lot more people, didn't care. I had moments of anxiety around, oh, someone's going to find out and what do they think of me? And still always watching my back and nervous to hold hands with another guy, that sort of thing. But by and large, just more comfortable. And felt sort of more like an adult, you know, a lot more agency. I think some of that was just having a bit more world experience, quite literally leaving the United States and seeing the United States from the outside is always gives great perspective, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you got back, and where were you going to school when you came back?
Cornell, upstate New York. Yeah.
Did you find yourself going out in different ways or like presenting yourself differently? Did you come out to more people?
I think I definitely wore tighter fitting clothes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Definitely just coming out to people all the time, no longer letting people assume if someone made a mistake and asked me about what girl I was dating or if there was some woman that I was interested in, I would immediately sort of clarify. I no longer felt comfortable lying. I might not always be straight, you know, sort of offer up my life, mm-hmm. but I would correct people if they were mistaken or if they made assumptions. I remember that.
Mm.
And this is not a great thing to admit or to feel, but I think in a way I felt better than the folks around me. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had achieved a little bit of truth that I didn't have before and that I was suddenly back in a space where it's harder to be yourself, but not me, because I had achieved that sort of up to a point. And
Did you have sort of a sense of what you want to do after school? Like, I know like there were a lot of options with sort of a liberal arts, you know, sort of background. So like, what was the trajectory that you were on for post-graduation?
I wanted to make a lot of money. That was my only goal. Okay. I went to college because I wanted to make money. I grew up pretty working class. My family struggled a lot. And I went to school pre-med. About two semesters in, I realized I was not cut out for that. And I was more interested in sort of international relations. So I thought I'll be a lawyer. I'll work for the State Department. I had all these ideas. And then when the time came, like many folks in my sort of cohort, we were all scrambling to find work. And it was, oh, if you can't do anything and you leave an Ivy League school, you can always consult, go work at Accenture or Goldman Sachs or do something like that. And I thought I'll do whatever it takes to just make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how it came to be. Maybe in my, I ended up studying government. In that coursework, I took a peace studies class, something along that line. Can't remember. And it involved a presentation from the Peace Corps. And I thought, maybe I'll do that. I want to travel a little bit, go to a different part of the world, see it from another perspective. And so they assigned me the Ivory Coast. And, you know, you get 6 months grace period to pay off your loans or something like that. 6 months, the Peace Corps gives you 6 months of deferment. And so I needed to sort of leave right away, but there was paperwork missing. And then I had gone to therapy and on college campus because I was having trouble coming out. And so because I admitted that in the paperwork, they then needed proof that I was mentally sound to be able to take the trip. And I thought it was just general therapy. But getting that letter was, just, anyway, long story short, had used up most of that 6 months grace period. And I didn't know how I was going to pay off my loans. And I felt bad asking my parents to pay my loans while I was away. That was the whole point of me going to college. I could get a job and take care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to figure that out. And in the process, met someone, fell in love, and we've been together ever since. So I didn't want to leave him.
Was that in Ivory Coast?
No, I didn't go to the Ivory Coast because—
Oh, that kept you from going.
That kept me from going, and 9/11 kept me from going.
Oh, okay. Well,
the world the World Trade Center had a Peace Corps office. And although my application wasn't there, it would slow down the process even more. So now it was December and I still, or it was around then, and I still hadn't gotten the assignment or had just gotten the assignment. And I had graduated already 6-7 months. So I had started paying back my loans and didn't know how I could defer them and not accumulate, you know, interest and back payments and all that stuff. So long story short, I stayed, and 6 months later, they sent all the volunteers home because there was a civil war in the Ivory Coast. Oh. So I guess it worked out for me, not for them.
So you were just sort of in a holding pattern, right? While you're waiting for all that.
Waiting. Yeah. And looking for work. And then, I did some,
did you stay around like Cornell, or like, where did you go?
We were living in Brooklyn, my partner and I was working at an education nonprofit that no longer exists, training volunteers to work in New York City public school classrooms. Then my partner had to move to the West Coast for work. I went with him. I went to public health grad school. And for 10 years, I worked in public health doing cancer research and HIV/AIDS advocacy and then teaching. And then I started writing, and here we are.
How did you meet your partner?
We reconnected. We'd met a couple years earlier through his ex, actually, but that's another story. On campus, we went to the same college.
Okay.
And then right before graduation, we ran into each other at a party.
Did you have like the experience that you had in Spain watching the Almodovar movie? Was that something that was in any way, like, did that continue to be a presence in your life? Did you watch more of his films when you came back to the U.S. or, you know?
Yes.
Okay.
After that, it's a thing. I watched every single Almodovar film. Mm-hmm. Every single new film is an event. I'm kind of bummed because the newest one, because of COVID and our kids and just traveling for the book, I haven't been able to get to a theater to see it. But I just saw that last night that it's available for streaming. Maybe that's a thing I'll do tonight. But yeah, every event, every movie is an event in our household. My partner loves Almodovar too. We have several extended friends and family who are huge fans. So I follow his work. I love it. And I love how he treats us sort of queer folks for the most part, right? I mean, there are definitely critiques here and there, and I don't always love how he treats women. Mm-hmm. There's a freedom. There's a kind of a queer misogyny that's okay because, you know, that's okay in quotes, I would say, because we're gay. And so we feel like we can, I don't know, get away with it in the way we talk or treat women. That's a longer conversation, but he did that film Talk to Her, in which the main character is in a coma. And while she's in a coma, one of the nurses rapes her. And she ends up pregnant, and the way he treats it is questionable. It kind of lessens the experience of rape, and it really becomes about the art of the love that is from the perspective of the nurse. So, you know, that's pretty shady. But generally speaking, I have loved his films, and in particular, because he, like I said, the Agrado character was amazing. It was kind of revolutionary for me to see someone so bold. And yes, she's a sex worker, but over the course of the film ends up kind of having access to more opportunities and ends up sort of the assistant, the All About Eve character to the lead. But she's a full person that you just love. There's no one who watches that film and doesn't walk away saying that is the breakout star and human, you know, person in this film. So he's done that in many of his films. You know, he sort of normalizes and centers queer lives.
When you were getting to know your partner, was that something like that you shared, that those movies, or was there another piece of culture that helped you feel like, oh, we have the same tastes?
Definitely film. He's also Spanish speaking. He's from Argentina. So Almodovar films are kind of very accessible to both of us. Not that if you don't speak Spanish, you can't, but no language barrier, that is. So that is definitely something. Every single night, I would say for most of our relationship, we end it on the couch watching something, whether a TV show or film. Sometimes, you know, I want to watch something, you know, with subtitles that's in black and white, or that, you know, there's no sound for half the film, and he'd rather watch a Star Trek film. So I've learned to love the Star Trek movies, and he's learned to appreciate some of the art house stuff that I'm into.
Sure. Yeah, there's I'm familiar with that kind of negotiation and
Oh, yes.
It's not exactly compromise because, you know, I think stuff that you would never, at least in my experience, stuff that I would never have given time to previously, you know, having the added value of, but somebody that I really likes this. So maybe I can find the important thing in it because I like sharing it with them.
For sure. And I would, as a anecdote or to prove that, my partner was very into sci-fi and fantasy books and films, and I'd never read, for example, The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter. So when we started dating, I thought, okay, I remember, I'll give this a try. So I read The Hobbit, I read the Lord of the Rings, and then we all those premieres were big events in our house, and we went to them like midnight screenings, and that was always very exciting. And I would never have explored those sorts of things if it weren't for him. That was not the type of film or book that interested me at all. And I have learned to enjoy, appreciate up to a point that stuff. I drew the line at Harry Potter, to be honest, because I read the first book, and although I found it enjoyable, I thought I haven't, at that point, I hadn't really read much of Toni Morrison. I'm like, I cannot justify reading any more Harry Potter. I'm a very slow reader, so I have to be very thoughtful about what I read. That said, I do love the films. And we watch the films now with our kids too, so that's pretty cool. But back to your earlier, what do we share? I was just thinking, anything, and maybe you do this too, maybe all queer folks do this, anything queer or gay, especially if it's gay, coming of age, love story, anything that looks like it's going to have the slightest bit of gay sex, we're always like, oh, let's watch that movie. Let's watch that movie. I think we've seen all of them, the good, the bad, the in between. Yeah.
You wind up watching some stuff that's not great. Like I say this as someone who's been to a lot of queer film festivals, and
Yes.
I can sometimes experience a sort of waning of my enthusiasm for supporting the community of filmmakers. Because I'm like, oh my God, another coming out story about a white guy. You know, like I've seen this story a million times. So I don't know. Like, do you have ones that like really stuck with you, and you're like, that is, you know, a formative text, or like that's our thing.
Yes, there is an Argentine director. Oh my God, I think his name is Miguel or Matias Piñedo. He's done several beautiful, slow appreciation of the male body films. It's always masculinity. It's always a group of guys hanging out, and there are two of them who are intensely attracted to each other, and you just wait sort of on the edge of your seat. Is there going to be a kiss? Is there going to be sex? Inevitably, there is. And so we always sort of sit through the pain of it all. Yeah, it's like 2 hours of edging, if that's what edging is. Actually, I don't know if that's it. And yeah, oh gosh, I wish I could tell you what his name was. He is Argentine. Pineda. I think his name is Matias or Miguel Pineda. He's very good. You should check him out. I'm trying to think of other ones that we, you know, My Beautiful Laundrette. That's something we've watched a couple times over the years. I love that movie.
That's a great one. You
Oh.
know, that really iconic lick moment is so like burned in my
Yes.
brain.
Yeah. And then recently I saw, we watched the Francis Lee movie, God's Own Country. I
Oh
don't know if
yeah,
you
I haven't
saw
seen
that.
that.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that is a wonderful, beautiful, sexy movie that I've watched now a couple of times. And I remember the reason it's kind of extra poignant for me is because it feels like the anti Brokeback Mountain, because there's a similar landscape and you think it's all headed towards tragedy, but there's hope in this film, tremendous hope, which I think is where I want to be with queer art. I mean, I love A Dark Tale as much as anyone else, and I don't want to sugarcoat reality, but I have seen and felt enough pain and suffering and shame And I am interested in stories that offer, even if just a glimpse of hope, I'll take it. I want that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready for those. So God's Own Country falls into that category.
Well, and tell me about like settling on the West Coast. How many years ago was it that you moved to this side of the country?
2003 to 2006, we were in Seattle.
Okay. So you came and you said that you went to grad school. So that must have taken up a pretty big chunk of time while your partner was working, doing what? What was it about you?
Computer, software. He's a software engineer.
Okay.
And I was, public health at the University of Washington.
Gotcha. Was there a point where you felt like this was maybe something temporary? You weren't sure if it was like the place where you would settle. And was there a time when you felt like, okay, no, we're settling into the routine that we actually want for our lives?
Yes and yes. It took me a long time to adapt to living in Seattle. I was born in New York. I'm a New Yorker, I feel, in every way.
Mm-hmm.
And living in Seattle felt a little like escaping reality or something. Like we were living in Capitol Hill at the time. Are you familiar with Seattle?
Yeah, I live on Capitol Hill in Seattle.
Oh, that's so funny. Okay. So 11th and between Harrison and Republican is where we live.
Okay.
And there just felt something very, I don't know, almost ghost towny about it. And I felt like I had run away from action, from life, from reality, from conflict. All of it just felt like it didn't exist there. It did. I just couldn't latch onto it. And I thought in a way, we'd retired to a quieter place. And at that age, that's not what I wanted. I wanted more life, more vibrancy, wanted to go see plays and music. And I eventually found all that. But like I said, we were there for 3.25 years. And I think it took about 2. There's also a way of being on the West Coast that I've felt, no disrespect to you, Matt, but I don't want to call it passive aggressive, but there is kind of everyone is very friendly, but it takes so long to make connections.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very difficult and I'm a people person, and I found it very difficult to make friends there.
Well, yeah. Coming from New York, I can imagine that. I mean, anywhere would be a little less direct than just being in New York.
Right, right. And it's exactly that. It's just a kind of a directness. I think New York gets a bad rap for being maybe abrasive or, as you said, at times rude or something. But I always think of it as just direct, honest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had really, that was my vibe. But the good side of that is, along with the adapting to living in the Pacific Northwest and the access to nature and eventually making friends, plus school, plus the job, I got to know folks. I got to know the owners of every restaurant that we went to and the regulars at every place that we went to and my elected officials. And that there was a kind of almost a small townness to it that it's very hard to achieve in New York City, or it's harder to achieve in a place like New York City. So I started to feel a little like a big fish in Seattle. And then it was very hard to leave. And along with that big fishness, there was also kind of some defenses dropped. I remember feeling like in Seattle, people didn't take everything personally, like a disagreement or a critique or, if I went to a restaurant, I'm not sure if, oh my gosh, well, let's get you something else. Oh God, how can we fix that? And I felt like all my life, whenever I was going to, in New York anyway, if ever I was going to push back a little bit, I had to kind of gear up for a deluge, someone's anger or, bad mood or defensiveness, whatever it was going to be. And I didn't feel that on the West Coast. And so I think when we moved back to New York, we moved back in a kind of a slower, calmer version of ourselves.
Mm.
That was nice.
Yes.
I don't know if it lasted.
Well, yeah. So tell me about, you were here for 3 years and then you went back east. Is that right?
I went back east. I finished school. My partner got offered another job and he needed a visa to stay in the country at the time. So these jobs are sort of, providing the visa. And then the new job was kind of not guaranteeing, but had signaled that they would help him get his residency, which they did. And eventually his citizenship.
Mm.
And so we kind of had to follow his work. But, when we were in Seattle, the thing is, same-sex marriage was happening in some of the provinces in Canada. It hadn't yet been federalized. And I remember going to a gay bar on Capitol Hill. I can't remember which one. It no longer exists. And we met a lesbian couple from Canada who just convinced us that we had to come to Canada and get married because they needed as many people to get married as possible so that if they tried to overturn it, there would be a large class action of some kind. It would just weigh more. And although we were in love, there was also a practicality to it. There's a political piece for sure, but there was a practicality to it. If my partner couldn't keep the visa and we had to leave the country, at least if we were married, maybe the four or five countries that recognized our relationship would allow us to come together. So yeah, so in 2003, we drove up, got our license at a London Drugs. And then 2 months later, because the process is different there, 2 months later, we got married.
Did you find did it change things for you? Was it a good idea? I mean, you're still together. So presumably it worked out.
Yeah. I mean, there were about 20 minutes after I said I do when I had this moment where I was like, what the fuck did I just do? Did I just get married? Like without even really thinking about it. And now to get out of this, I have to get divorced. And that feels huge. That almost feels bigger than the marriage to get divorced. Or maybe we can annul it. Is that a thing here in Canada? I was thinking all this while the marriage commissioner or some person in the park was snapping pictures of us and our witnesses, our two friends. And that's where my mind was. I had this big white smile and I kept thinking, this was a disaster, a huge mistake. What did I do? I didn't take this seriously. That lasted about 20 minutes. Nothing changed between us after that. But I still call my partner, as you can hear. It's hard for me to say husband. I've never really adapted to that. Sometimes in official capacity, when I feel like I'm being disrespected by some sort of insurance or credit card company, then I kind of whip out husband.
It's nice to have in your pocket for when you need it, or for when you're talking to somebody who doesn't speak the language of partner.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
So when you came back to New York, is that where you were you like, all right, now we're settling here?
Yeah. I think at that point it was bittersweet. Like I said, we had both of us really taken a liking to Seattle. So we were going back twice a year for several years. And I was working, I was doing cancer research and then teaching at a university in the public health program. And then we adopted our first kid. And then we were thinking, maybe we don't want to live in Seattle. Maybe we'd prefer to be in New York. And then we adopted our second child. And then we were convinced this is where we're staying.
What made you decide to adopt?
Like have children at all or adopt versus surrogacy, you mean?
Well, yeah, I guess, why did you decide to have kids and what was the journey to, and this is the process that we want to explore.
We had both, I think in the first few months of dating had that conversation, kind of romantic conversation about the future when you think everything is going to work out and be wonderful. And we both wanted kids and, okay, great. How are we going to do that? And I think both of us were on board immediately with adoption because there are children and there are systems that make it so that folks can't parent and to look at adoption. But for the most part, there will always be children who need, an adoptive family. And so that was the conversation back then. Yeah, if we ever do this, it'll be adoption. But we're not accidentally going to get pregnant. So how are we going to get on this timeline? What will we do? And we said, what about at 10 years? Let's revisit this in 10 years. And if we still want kids, then we'll go to an orientation meeting. Mm-hmm. And almost to the day, I think it was 2011, we said, okay, this is our 10th year. And it kind of dovetailed with we're not having the fun we used to have by just going out every night and having drinks and going to see shows and having friends over. And, that we wanted something a little bit more. We were ready for the next sort of phase of our lives. And we just happened to both agree on what that phase would be. And so we went to an orientation meeting. And within 10 months, we got a call saying there's a baby. The baby is 3 weeks old. And 2 weeks later, we brought him home.
Wow. How did that change your life? I'm going to imagine it was pretty significant.
It was, it is, continues to be. It, well, it anchored us to our home more. You know, we really didn't have the freedom to be out and about as often as we wanted to. We had a lot of memberships to theaters and museums and things lapse, at least at the beginning. And it changed also where our center was. Our center used to be out, the East Village, Williamsburg, wherever in New York we were going to be out and about. And our center became our apartment. And so we were one of the few in our group of friends, in our social circle, to have kids at that age or at that point. And so Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, Sundays, sometimes Tuesdays became dinner at our place. So we started hosting more friends. And most of our socializing, I would say, for the last 10 years has been dinner parties and summers whenever we were like rent a summer place or something like that. Because, and folks understood, you know, it's just harder to do stuff. We still went out, we went to things. I mean, when we adopted our first kid, it was in the heels of Occupy Wall Street. And I was very involved in Occupy Wall Street. And so I would just bring this infant with me in like a, you know, one of those carriers slings, and I would just take him to all the meetings. So we didn't stop participating in the world, but definitely our socializing became more of a home-based thing. And the benefit of that has been that our kids are very comfortable around adults, always have been, around groups of people, and actually consider all of our adult friends their friends, which is kind of cute. But yeah, that's mostly how it's changed.
Now, so you've got a book that just came out. Tell me about the process of writing that and what it's about and how the book tour has been going.
Right. I wrote a book called The Town of Babylon. It's a novel. And I had written a collection of short stories, which I was having trouble selling. It seems to be the rite of passage for many short story writers. Mm-hmm. And the publishers who were interested wanted me to send them a novel first, or to take the manuscript of short stories and make it a novel, which I had no interest in doing. Mm-hmm. And so I resisted, and my agent kept coming back to me with bites that said, okay, they really want this, but they want a novel first. And I just couldn't do it. And I think out of frustration, I said, fine, fuck it. I'm going to write the damn novel that they want. And I sat down and wrote that novel in about 13 weeks. And with a break in between, I did 3 to 6 weeks, and then 3 weeks, and then 10 weeks at the end of the year. And I wrote it as fast as I could. As I tried to be thoughtful about it. I mean, I didn't write it as angry as I sounded. I sat down to write it sort of as I thought, I'm a working writer and I have to make this work. I need a paycheck. So if this is the way I'm going to get paid, then I'll do it. So, and I had a story I wanted to tell.
Yeah, well, take me back to writing those short stories. Like, how long have you been writing, and where did those appear?
I started writing shortly after we adopted our first child. I was spending a lot of time at home teaching at night. So during his naps, I would write what I thought was going to be a screenplay. And a friend of mine, a director, he was visiting, and he said, well, what do you want the screenplay to be about? And I said, well, no, he said, no. Tell me what the first paragraph is. So we were walking down the street in Brooklyn, and I just sort of spoke out for the first time what I thought could be the first paragraph. He said, now go home and write it. So I went home and I wrote it, and it was this screenplay. It was ended up becoming a short story because I didn't know how to format it correctly. I said, oh, I'll reformat later. Mm-hmm. But it looked like a short story. It was about a waiter who is coming home. He lives in the suburbs and he works in Manhattan, and on the way home he witnesses a murder on the train, and then he spends the entire short story coming up with excuses and reasons and explanations for why he is not going to report what he saw. And it's a kind of indictment of the United States and immigration and police and everything. And it got published. I mean, it got rejected, but then it got published. And so then I thought, I could take a lot of my public health work and the things that most fascinate me and make them the themes to these short stories. So I had what I thought was something like public health fiction, which nobody really liked that tagline. and so when I'd written like 30 and maybe a dozen were in great shape. And the last one, I think before they went, my agent tried to sell the collection, was published in Harper's, and I had the Boston Review and I don't know, a few other places, the Rumpus. And
I mean, those are pretty good for somebody who's just like striking out on, in a writing career. Those, it sounds like you're really in good company.
Yeah. I think for a lot of reasons, but for sure, because I didn't come from the MFA world, I had a bit of imposter syndrome. So every time I had that success or that I was published, I convinced myself, oh God, there's just like, this is luck. And it just happens. I'm getting lucky in each of these places, but this place would never publish me again, or the next place isn't going to publish me. And, but then I heard enough positive stuff that I thought, okay, you know what? And also I read enough garbage in the world that I thought, okay, my stuff can hang too, this will be okay. And then I transitioned to the short story collection. Oh, by the way, I wrote a short story that appeared in the Brooklyn Rail that's called The Threesome That Led to Spike Lee. And it's about a couple who meets a film director who then one day that film director convinces the narrator to write a screenplay, which he then wants to put into the hands of Spike Lee. And he spends the entire story trying to get it into the hands of Spike Lee. So I got a little meta there. But yeah. And then the novel, I wrote it, put the last page down, and 3 or 4 weeks later where it was lockdown. So now I had this first draft manuscript that I hadn't read, and I just set it aside. My partner was kind of the primary breadwinner. So I became the primary care parent, and I had two kids trying to do homeschooling during the pandemic. And at about 6 months in, we got a call saying that my publisher wanted to buy the collection and was the novel ready, because they wanted to consider that too. So my partner took like a couple of days off work. I didn't sleep for 5 days, and I edited the hell out of that as quickly as I could. And that's the book that I'm on tour now promoting.
Yeah. Wow. That's, a ton of work, but it sounds like there must've been something important in you that needed to come out. It sounds like you wrote really fast and really intensely. And, the fact that it's in people's hands and they want it, suggests to me that, you had something urgent to say.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. I hope it gets into more hands. I'm just in the last leg of like a 20 city tour or 20 stop tour, because I had multiple stops in some cities, and I hadn't been on a plane in 7 years. I don't like public speaking. So this has been sort of the hard part of a writing career. I had convinced myself that I would be able to write from my, from my office or my room, and just every year send a manuscript to a publisher and they would publish it. I thought that I could do that. I saw that a thing like that Twitter existed. I knew Instagram existed. I knew that people were out there doing readings and there were posters and things, but I didn't want anything to do with that. I really just wanted to write and not put myself out there. And I've had a bit of a rude awakening, and these last 6 months have been about putting myself out there, and it's and I treat it very much like a job. So writing the perfect tweet and the perfect Instagram post and the perfect email, these are all tasks that take up probably too much of my day, but they're daily, as much as writing is, more so even.
Yeah. So tell me about like how the book tour has been, like what's the experience been like? And I imagine you miss your family a lot too.
Very much. I'm back in Brooklyn right now, and I have 3 events here in the city and then 2 in Massachusetts next week. And then the rest is just virtual stuff and some interviews that are coming up, but I'm hoping that will be the end of it for now. But it's been going great. I kind of punched a little up above my weight. Is that the expression? Above my weight? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
I asked writers who I had a lot of respect for, folks who have had much more storied and successful careers, if they would be my partners in these conversations. And I did a lot of reaching out. My publicist did a lot of reaching out, and we made some great contacts. And so people that I really respect have been supportive and have met me in their favorite bookstores in Seattle, in Portland, in LA, San Francisco, Tucson, Georgia, and now Massachusetts and New York. And so that has really kind of both, it's given me quite a boost in terms of attention and respect. And so I've been very, in that way, fortunate. I mean, I worked for it, but also all of those people could have said no, thank you. And a lot of people did, but these folks didn't. And so I'm very grateful to them.
Yeah. Wow. So tell me about where folks can find your book and connect with you online and see those meticulously crafted tweets.
Well, the book should be available at any independent bookstore in the country. That's my hope. And you can find me online, and you can find it online also at the big places. And you can find me online at Instagram, alejandrovarela.work. My website is alejandrovarela.work. And my Twitter account our handle is drovarela, @dro, DROVARELA. And that's where you'll find me posting.
That sounds great.
Thirst traps, so they go buy my book.
Fantastic. Oh, you know how to market. Great.
Yeah.
Well, Alejandro, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Matt, for this.
Thanks to Alejandro for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into pop culture history at youtube.com/MattBaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod and comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.